Welcome to White Collar Crime Talks with Nina and Joe, an ABA Criminal Justice Section Just Pod series, where leading white collar practitioners discuss hot topics and emerging trends in government investigations and enforcement.
Hello, everyone. This is Joe Whitley. I'm with the Womble Bond Dickinson Law Firm. I head up their white collar practice nationally and internationally, and served in the government in several places in the Department of Justice and Homeland Security. I'm joined today by Nina Marino, my partner in crime today, to start the inaugural episode of White Collar Talks, which is going to be a version of Car Talk. If any of you have ever heard that program on Saturday morning, it's really delightful. And what we want to do is bring you a program that you enjoy, talking about white collar criminal issues. Nina?
Hi, everybody. I'm Nina Marino. I am a partner at Kaplan Marino. We're based in Los Angeles. We are a white-collar practice. I specialize primarily in white-collar defense and also some complex criminal litigation, both domestically and sometimes internationally when it comes to extradition matters. Joe, love being with you on this podcast. We've got a couple of amazing initial guests to kick off our podcast, and I'm just delighted to be a part of this project.
Well, you and I go way back, but I know a lot of our connectivities happen through the criminal justice section. You know, you've been very active in the section, and so have I. And I think it's really appropriate today to start off this White Collar Talks series with an interview, a conversation, really a dialogue with two of the people that put together the annual ABA White Collar Crime Institute. And one of those is Ray Benoon. And Ray has been putting this institute together, this next edition in Miami of this coming year in March. And we'll hear more about that from Ray in a few moments. Will be the 38th edition of that program. And Ray is known throughout the white collar criminal defense world as the leading white collar criminal defense practitioner. And for many years, he was with a major law firm here in Washington now, but he's now moved to his own practice with the Benoon Law Firm and still consulted on any number of issues. And so I will not go on too much longer about Ray, but Ray obviously has a background as an assistant U.S. attorney, like many of us do. And he was here in the District of Columbia where I'm sitting today, and he headed the fraud section. With Ray today is Maggie O'Donnell, who is an experienced trial attorney who focuses on white-collar criminal defense and civil matters. And Maggie represents individuals and corporations in government investigations. She has a long vitae, and I won't go through all of it, but she's a former public defender for the District of Columbia. Anything further to add, Nina, about our two guests?
No, let's jump right in. Ray, welcome, welcome. You know, I love seeing you whenever I get to do that. 38 years ago, Ray Benoon, you had an idea, you had a dream, you had a vision, and that was to create a National Institute for White Collar Crime. What motivated you? I mean, you have created a legacy. So where was the inspiration?
Well, actually, it's pretty interesting because when we came up with the idea, I was the chair of the White Collar Crime Committee of the Criminal Justice Section, and our total membership was probably around 50, and our attendance at our meetings that we had maybe once a month were about 10, maximum 12, mostly DC lawyers with two coming from Chicago and two or three coming from New York. And we met in an office at the American Bar Association Criminal Justice Section that had with the blue chairs and the extra furniture that was being discarded right all around us. So it was not exactly a wonderful setting. But we were talking at one point about how we could actually increase the membership and maybe find a place to move the meetings to a better location and what else we could do to create interest in white collar. The white collar bar was really beginning, was in its infancy. Big law firms were beginning to actually consider the idea of having anything resembling white collar even be acknowledged as being in their firm, so long as it wasn't called criminal. It was really mostly an East Coast practice around New York and Washington and Chicago. There was some in LA really beginning to develop, mostly firms like yours, Nina, small boutique firms. One of the ideas we came up with was somebody said, how about doing a CLE program? And the thought was, you know, CLE by itself was really not going to do it. It was not going to last, and it was not going to attract a lot of people. So just having a CLE program would take a lot of effort, but not really translate into something meaningful for the white-collar bar for what we were trying to accomplish. So as we were kicking around the idea that, well, you know, the ABA manages to get, when they have the litigation group annual meeting, or the ABA itself, when they have their annual meeting, they get a lot of people there. And so the thought was, again, I don't know whether I was the one who came up, but somebody came up with the idea of, well, why don't we make it more an annual meeting of the White Collar Bar? Because the thought was, most people in the White Collar Bar at that time knew each other. Whether they were anywhere in the United States, they knew each other. I mean, people in those days really moved. And if you did white collar practice, you were on an airplane all the time. Whether you're on the West Coast or the East Coast, you're always traveling to meet the client because there just weren't enough white collar lawyers around. So the thought was this would be a good idea to actually have everybody come together once a year and have really talk about what has been happening in the year, get to see each other, and also the throw in CLE credit because then you could have another reason to justify the expense and to get law firms to pay to send people. And so the idea was to call it an annual meeting of the White Collar Bar with a program. And the thought was to have as much happening outside the room as inside the room. So it had to be in a hotel that had a lot of space outside the main meeting rooms. And the thought was to have things happening, receptions and things happening in the evenings. So the first consideration was where to have it and when to have it. We had to exclude big cities because if we had it in LA or New York or Washington, people would go back to their offices right after they finished their panel and would not be seen again. So the thought was, well, we should have it, first of all, exactly the same time every year. So everybody knows that those two dates are the annual meeting of the White Collar Bar, and have them in warm or semi-warm places. So it would give you away from big cities and away from bad weather. So obviously Miami was immediately came to mind. And we thought we'd launch it in Miami. And the thought was when? Of course, since we're all from cold places, colder places, somebody said, well, how about January? It's cold as can be in Chicago. It's really bad weather in New York. So wouldn't it be nice to get away in January in Miami? So we basically decided to do it sometime at the end of January. I think it was the last week in January in Miami or in Florida. We really had no idea how many people we would be getting. And we thought, gee, if we had 50 people the first year, it might be a good beginning. So immediately somebody said, well, you know, Boca Raton, and do it at the country club there, Boca Raton Resort and Country Club. And so we asked the ABA if they were interested. The ABA was, and they thought they could make it a national institute. And somebody called at the ABA, called the Boca Raton, Country Club, Resort and Country Club, and made a reservation. So we were really delighted that we could actually get a place to accept us, because I think we were doing this. This was probably in the fall already of the year before. Until about a week later, when we got a call from a manager at the hotel basically saying that they were fully booked when we wanted them, and somebody obviously who talked to us was too junior and made a mistake. It later turned out that they had seen the name of the institute that was called White Collar Crime, and they didn't want anything associated with them, that at their place. So we had to hustle to find an alternative. And the only alternative we could really come up with that was reasonably priced so we could get government officials, because it was really critical that this be a program that would be attended by government people as well as defense. And so we ended up with what used to be the Hollywood Resort, which was really a dump back then. It was a union hotel, so it was mostly attendance for very low-level expense-related meetings. And we had it there, and we decided to have it there. And we decided to have it over a day and a half. And just before we got there, we realized we would have about 75. What we didn't realize is the 75 included probably 20 speakers. So we were within the 50 people range, and we had really good people from the government. Steve Trott was our main speaker and was going to be our main everything from the government. And he was the Assistant Attorney General of the Criminal Division at the time. And we had our main sponsor, the only reception we had, everything was Zuckerman Spader. I don't know how Zuckerman Spader got to do it, but they were there and they did it. And Sandy, I believe, was there. And so we went there, and it was the first day was really beautiful. In fact, it was so beautiful that it was impossible to get people to stay in the room because it was cold everywhere else. So we literally had, most people were at the pool. And when the audience was low in the room, we had to run to the pool and get people to come in their bathing suits just to show that there were people in the room. But interestingly, at the end of the first day, there was a massive snowstorm on the East Coast. And we were stuck for two extra days there. So we were stuck for the whole weekend and really couldn't get out of there to get back home until that Sunday. And so Steve Trott actually stayed with us. He was our evening entertainment. He did magic tricks at dinner. That was the entertainment. It really turned out it was too expensive for actually even government employees because it was higher than their per diem. So he literally spent the last two nights on the beach. But in any event, so when we got back, we decided January was out of the question. Too much risk of snowstorms. So we decided really to push it to the first Thursday and Friday in March. And that's how the first Thursday and Friday became the annual dates. And we decided we would alternate between Miami and New Orleans. And so that's where we're at. I mean, it was really, the intent was really, again, annual meeting of the White Collar Bar, add the CLE, make it important so that the government would show up and the major people in the defense bar.
Well, let me jump right to the, not back to the future, but maybe to the future, and ask Maggie O'Donnell to talk a little bit about her perspective. She's at Zuckerman Spader, and I know, Ray, you just mentioned Zuckerman being a big part of the initial program, and it looks like that may have continued. Maggie, with you, can you talk a little bit about some of what you're doing present day, right? Does that sound like a good...
Let me say one thing to introduce the involvement of Zuckerman Spader, because that's really important. About 5 years ago, I actually decided to leave the big law firm where I had been for all my life, at least since leaving the government, and set up my own law firm. And so I thought it was also time to start thinking. I mean, I had been thinking about that for about 10 years, the last 10 years. Who is going to start taking over this program? Because if you're in a big law firm, you can have staff to help out, but it takes a lot of effort and a lot of manpower. And we had tried bringing in other law firms to try and do it where they expressed an interest. And once they, within a few weeks of realizing the amount of work that went into it, they were gone. And so I remember sitting down with having lunch with Roger Zuckerman and saying, Roger, this is an opportunity because I'd like to really get out of doing this. And I think this is a great opportunity for you guys to step in. And he thought it was a great idea. And I met after that with the leaders of the firm, and they thought it was a great idea. At the time, Carolyn Maida was a partner at Zuckerman Spader, and she was on the executive committee or management committee. And she volunteered to actually step in and help out. And they got immense resources. I think Maggie was one of the first recruits. And of course, after that, Carolyn left to go to Going House. So Maggie, and they've done an amazing job.
Thank you, Ray. And Nina, Joe, thank you so much for having me here. It's exciting to be with you and to be part of this inaugural discussion. And I just loved hearing Ray's recitation of chapter one of the history of the conference, because, you know, I've heard some of it in bits and pieces, but just listening to what hustle it took and what creativity it took to put it together, and then to see what it is now, you know, it really is one of the biggest, I think it is the largest ABA conference, and it's a big part of what this practice means. It's a big part of what the white collar community does. And I really felt that most recently at the meeting we had just earlier this year, you know, which is our sort of first post pandemic. We had one during the pandemic, an in-person one as well, but this one was, you know, had more people in it, and it felt like a reunion. And I think people see the meeting and the conference as an opportunity to reconnect across the country internationally. And so I just want to thank Ray for putting this together so many years ago and for getting our firm involved as well. And I'm happy to say a couple of minutes about the firm's involvement, but, you know, Roger Zuckerman, who is a wonderful person, and Ray, I think, go a long way back, and so does Sandy and other people at our firm. And when Ray came to us about helping with the conference, there was no question that we would do it, you know, both because of the relationship with Ray and because of the importance of the conference. And it's very important to us to be involved in putting it together, get our folks involved on our side. Currently, Eitan Goldman is sort of the co-chair. Before him, it was Caroline Maida. I support them in lots of different ways. We have staff sort of behind me who also support this, who are critical, Kim Ganey, Dan Emzalag, who have really been, I think, helpful in putting it together, but also thinking about how we can try new things out at the conference. And I think Ray and the ABA has been very receptive to trying out new panels, reaching out to, you know, in different areas. And I'm hoping that that's a role that we can continue to play.
So we've really come a long way, Ray and Maggie, from running out of the conference to the pool to get the people in their bathing suits into the meeting rooms.
Although, Nina, I mean, sometimes that might still happen at the Miami conference.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, though, it really doesn't have to, because those meeting rooms are full. I started going to this conference when I decided I wanted to be a white-collar lawyer. I looked around and thought, well, how am I going to do that? And it was this conference that opened the door for me. And my first conference was 1997. I was less than a 10-year lawyer then. And it's changed my practice. But getting back to the bathing suits again, which is, of course, most interesting, I'll throw this one to you, Ray. So we know you started out with about 50 people in the room. What has the attendance grown to over these 38 years? And what has changed about where you're having the conferences, right? Because you said that you started out between Miami and New Orleans. What has changed and what does the location of the conference look like for the future? Why don't we start there? But I'm telling you, I'm giving you a little like preview. I'm going to want to transition into government involvement over the years and what you see, because that is obviously integral, right? Because as an attendee, you know, as a private practicing lawyer, interactions with those in government is incredibly valuable. And I'm not really aware of any other conference that brings that kind of value to the table, in addition to networking between other, you know, private practicing colleagues. It's that, you know, that government connection. So I guess where I am is attendance, location, and government involvement.
Well, actually, it's very interesting how it grew, because the second year that we did it in New Orleans, we had about 150, so we pretty much doubled in size. It was a very nice small hotel. It was really good because people could really talk and spend time together. We did not have breakout sessions. We had one session each, so it was only one. So it was tiny, but we had a luncheon with a speaker. And the third year, we were at, I believe, around 250. And we were beginning to have problems in that hotel because main room was really for 200 people, the ballroom. The dining room where we had our luncheon was really for 200 people. So we had to have an extra room with tables, with a screen. So nobody, of course, sat in the extra room. They all left because there was no point seeing the speaker on a screen. So that really told us right away we needed bigger hotels. And New Orleans was such that once you got to the bigger hotels, they were older hotels. They were older, sort of run-down hotels. So that's when we thought, well, Miami was easy because there was always the Fontainebleau. So we thought, how about San Francisco? San Francisco is not Los Angeles, so a lot of the people are coming from Los Angeles, so they won't be able to go back to work during the day. So let's get them to San Francisco. And so we did, basically, we started doing Miami and San Francisco. And so we started by expanding slow. It expanded, really got beyond our control, because I think by the fourth or fifth year, we were over 500. And by the seventh, eighth year, we were at over 900. And by then, we had grown out of the St. Francis. I think the ballroom only took 900 people. And the last year, we had so much standing room that we had to tell people to leave because of fire regulations. So Fontainebleau was great until the Fontainebleau converted, closed down to rebuild. So I think that was next door at, what is it called, Eden Rock, I believe.
And that's it.
And that was great. And that was a staple of our for many years until, of course, they were bought out and decided to become a boutique hotel, not taking large conferences anymore. But by then, we had grown, the practice had grown, the white collar practice nationally had grown tremendously. Every law firm, every major law firm was developing a white collar practice. There were a lot of smaller law firms developing. And so the attendance grew, but also we were beginning to get some foreign involvement, some non-US lawyers involved. And interestingly, the person who really helped a lot with that was this one lawyer that I actually met when the ABA was in London, and I was still the chair of the White Collar Crime Committee of the Criminal Justice Section, and the ABA was going to have an annual meeting somewhere in the U.S. and then in London, and we wanted to have a panel in London, and we had this panel with about five speakers in London. And I asked around to find out from some of the contacts I had in Europe, who is a good lawyer to have in London who does white collar work? And immediately, right away, everybody said, Monty Raphael. And so I put Monty Raphael on the panel, and I remember going and meeting with him to prepare for the panel just before the panel. I was not the moderator of the panel. And so we had a couple of British speakers. It turned out that I was the pre-last speaker on the panel, and Monty was the last speaker. And the panel was at 3:30 or thereabout, ending at around 4:30. And by the time they got to me, I literally had 2 minutes to speak, and Monty had one. And when Monty spoke, he said, I hate to do this to all of you and have you listen to another speaker with a weird speaking weird English. So why don't we instead, this is now tea time. And so why don't we just stop this panel and let's have tea and talk over tea. And so that's what happened. And during that, when I met with him afterwards, I told him about the White Collar Crime Committee that I chaired in for the criminal justice section. And he said, that's really wonderful. I'd like to join. Can non-US lawyers join? I said, sure. I'm trying to get membership up. And so he joined, and literally the White Collar Crime Committee then after that grew so significantly. And by the time I stopped being the chair, we had about 300 members. And Monty was the only non-US lawyer. And he started coming to the White Collar Crime Institute. And actually, he became known in London circles as the lawyer who went to this conference in the United States and came back with clients. It really encouraged other lawyers to do that. And interestingly, at the time, the International Bar Association was seeing how well this white collar was developing in the United States, that they asked Monty if he would chair a committee. But they didn't want crime in the business section of the International Bar, so they put us as a subcommittee of a committee in the environmental committee of the business section. And they tested us for 2 years, and Monty was the chair the first 2 years, and I was the chair the subsequent 2 years. And eventually, they realized that was a great practice, and they became a full committee. But that really generated the interest, and now we have a significant international group, maybe over 100 lawyers will come. And to answer your last question, Nina, our hope is that, it's becoming more and more difficult to find hotels. We now have to make reservations 5 years in advance. One thought that I was kicking around with the Zuckerman group is to maybe have more of the meetings in Miami, because there are more hotels there. We get an average of pre-pandemic, we hit 1,450 attendants. We usually get about 200 fewer on the West Coast.
1,450 is a far cry from 50 people, right?
It really is.
Right.
And that does not include, when you think about it, at least a dozen to 15 private receptions that are open to almost everybody. And a lot of the people who go to those receptions, I hate to say this, often come to the Institute and never register. Or if they don't register, they at least come and stay in the hallway and talk to other people. So I would say you probably need to add another few hundred. We generally have about 100 people probably who register and do not even show up. They register just to get the material. And we probably have about 150 at least who show up on the day of the conference to register. So they're not pre-registered.
So Ray, there are so many, and Maggie, so many topics to cover. The white collar area has become a real spectrum of different issues. The enforcement policies of the Department of Justice have changed. They've moved away from, depending on the administration, this administration appears to be moving away from more street crime enforcement back to environmental enforcement, back to enforcement of other issues, dealing with what's going on in the boardroom of corporate America, what's happening there, what kind of decisions are they making, and And those decisions can sometimes be criminal in content. But as you're putting together these programs, I want to really ask both you and Maggie, what are some of the things you're thinking about? And do you have people helping you put together the program? It has to be really a constellation of issues that you've got to somehow condense into. It sounds crazy, say condensing into almost a three-day program, but you have so many issues that are so topical. What are some of the things you both are doing now to sort of plan the 23 program coming up in terms of topics? So Maggie, maybe you could start us and Ray jump in.
Well, I think one thing that's surprising to a lot of people and perhaps something that distinguishes the Institute is how early we begin planning. We do begin thinking about, well, as Ray said, the location and dates, those are set years in advance. But we start planning and thinking about the next conference shortly after the conference just finished. There's a planning committee. You know, Joe, you've always been such an important part of the leadership group that I think in some ways serves as a brainstorming resource of ideas about what the conference should be dealing with. And Ray can speak to this as well. There are often sort of preset panels in big picture concepts, right? Are we going to have an antitrust one, environmental, healthcare, fraud, all of these issues which are permanent spheres in the white collar practice. But within that, thinking about what is the topic going to be this year, who is going to be on it, I think there is a desire and an effort to make it contemporaneous with what is happening. When there are big trials, for example, that impact the white collar world, that shape what DOJ is doing, those are things that the conference is trying to talk about, trying to get the people who tried those cases or other people who are quite involved. And then I think that you will also see that there are panels that change every year. And so last year, I think for the first time, the conference had a panel of former criminal defendants, individuals and entities. And that was very moving. It was very well attended. It was extremely powerful. There was also a cultural reviews panel, something that we've been doing for the first time. And there are spaces, I think, where to try out new topics and to sort of reflect what is happening in this practice. Ray, what do you think?
Yeah,
with a longer view?
One of the interesting things that Maggie said is she mentioned some of the really things that we would never have thought about having a few years ago. But one of the things we tried last year, which was actually, unfortunately, not very well attended, but very good, was having a panel of just four prosecutors. So we had four supervisory AUSAs, one U.S. attorney and three supervisory AUSAs. And they talked about ethical issues that confront prosecutors. Now, I really think it's unfortunate more defense attorneys did not see that, because it really shows that they actually do consider the ethical issues, that they are, I think they were very open about how strict they are with their staff about it. That was another very interesting thing. And so one of the things that in the past, the Justice Department in prior administrations was not interested, they were not interested in having DOJ people moderating panels. Now they're not. And so in the past few years, we've had actually Department of Justice lawyers being the moderators, which is also very interesting. We also have had academics involvement. But one of the things that we've got is we have a planning committee of about 30 lawyers. It's a combination. Really, we try to come up with experienced lawyers, established lawyers, a lot of younger lawyers who are up and coming in the white collar practice, and get ideas from them. And that pro panel, actually, we meet with that committee only twice a year. But what happens behind the scenes with the committee members is much more important, because you start wanting geographical balance on the panel, and so that people who come from the West Coast see some West Coast people. So we want the people on the panel reflect who attends. So the broader the number of people on the panel, young, more experienced, etc., the more it's going to reflect who's going to be coming in the audience. And so we call you, Joe or Nina, and say, what do you think, who are the people we should consider in your area, and can you recommend people? And it's very, very helpful because, I mean, you get into some areas where we may not be intimately familiar as to who are the people doing it. One example is we're doing a panel in coming next March on digital currency and cryptocurrency. And I really must say, I don't know, I'm not actively involved in that area. So Nina was very helpful in not only identifying people that we would never have come up with, but also suggesting some areas. So I think that's what's really very important, the fact that it's not, I mean, there's a view because it's really interesting. After the conference, you get a lot of very good emails. People saying how wonderful it was. And then you always get one or two that say, you only get your friends in and nobody else. And it's really not true. If it were only our friends, we must have a hell of a lot of friends, you know, around. But it's really, we try to go with experience, substance. So we want panels that reflect the practice. We'll give different viewpoints. So we don't want a single viewpoint. And so that we really want balanced panels, balanced in terms of viewpoints, balanced in terms of geography, balanced in terms of reflection on what the white collar bar is.
Yeah, and I think even, you know, even more than that, Ray, just, you know, my observations, I'm the co-director of continuing legal education for the criminal justice section. And several years ago, we made it very clear to all conference planners that we needed to see diversity on panels. And the National Institute on White Collar Crime has really, really embraced that directive. We now see on the panels at the conference tremendous balance of gender, tremendous diversity, cultural diversity. I think the goal always was geographic diversity, but you've really, really propelled that initial undertaking to a whole different level by bringing in people from, you know, from all over, not just geographic diversity in the United States, but you have international panelists now, and you have tremendous cultural diversity. And as I said, you really embrace the gender diversity. And I think that my observation is anyway that the flexibility you have embraced in the content of the programming has really made the conference never be stale, ever. It always feels fresh, it always feels new, and that's really a tribute to your progressive posture with respect to the planning of the conference.
Well, you know, Nina, one thing that's important in that respect is I think that's what Maggie and Carolyn Mehta helped a great deal on, is that they have also a circle of lawyers they know. We have on the planning committee several lawyers who are experienced lawyers who helped found and are leaders of the women's white collar bar. And so I think what one of the things that cannot be said about it is that we sort of have diversity for the sake of diversity. I mean, we do have a diverse group of panelists, but any of them are leaders in their field. And so substantively, they are the top players in the white collar bar. So I think that's what's really good. So it wasn't, it's, and the other thing is by adding the regional panels, you are able to add lawyers from cities that we've never had before on panels. And that's what's so good about it, because they can then bring and talk about what developments in their particular region. But I think having Maggie plays a significant role. I mean, what we try to do is really split the program three ways, or as close to three ways as possible, so that we can each get a do part of it, and then we're not overloaded, but also we get together and say, all right, who are the women, who are the people, you know, Maggie, in your circle and the larger circle of people that you know all over the country who practice white collar, who would be really up and coming and are really good. Aton is the same way. We do the same thing. And we do it with the planning committee. So that, I think, is it goes to keeps the freshness, but also the combination of experience. So you do have some repeat faces with experience, but also you have some fresh blood.
Maggie, do you have anything to add to what Ray just shared?
I think, I agree with what Nina and Ray have discussed in terms of how the conference has changed and the changes in folks who are coming to the conference and who are on the panels. And it's interesting sometimes in hearing Ray talk about the origins of the conference, you know, how nascent in some ways the white collar area is. And Ray founded with others the Institute, and thinking about who will be the leaders of the Institute or this practice in 20, 30 years, what cities will they be from, what will be the areas. Those are all things that I think are important to reflect in our panels and also in our attendees. And I hope all of us are reaching out to people who may not think to come to the Institute. And I try to do that a lot. Hey, this is really great. You should come. You know, I'm going to be there, and just reach out to people, invite them, because the more, the merrier. And it really is such a terrific experience. And we need all of us to be kind of broadening our circles and doing that.
And, you know, in that context, one of the significant things has been to keep costs low. So our registration fees are among the lowest of any conference, so that firms can send younger people. And also we stay in hotels that will give us special rates so that government lawyers can attend and be within their per diem. Those are issues that are very important, because as Nina said, it is critical that the government be a very important part of this conference. And we have, the interesting thing is, we've had attorneys general speaking, making keynote speeches. We've always had the deputy attorney general or the several assistant attorneys general speak, and all the supervisory personnel of the fraud section of the criminal division. But interestingly, starting 2 years ago, we started having the civil division, commercial branch, and the fraud branch, government fraud branch, because they are bringing now some criminal cases, believe it or not. Right. And some of them are administrative cases and enforcement cases. But the other interesting thing we're going to have, thanks to you, Joe, and to Gus Eiler in the Civil Division of the Justice Department, is we're going to have a consumer fraud panel in March that has the FTC, the FDA involved, the supervisors in charge of fraud there. We're going to have on your panel the export control people at Treasury. We're going to have OFAC director. We have National Security Division. We have Homeland Security also appearing. So it's really interesting, something that was limited to fraud section and the criminal division and U.S. Attorney's Office, all of a sudden is expanding to so many other agencies, because so many other agencies fraud is becoming so wide-ranging.
Yeah. Ray, it's not my job to ask questions here, but one thing that I think is very exciting about the conference is seeing the government at the highest levels use it as an opportunity to announce new policies and to really educate the practitioners about where their enforcement priorities are and so forth. And I'm curious how long that has been happening for, and when you saw that shift over the growth of the conference.
We were very lucky. We were very lucky because several of the Assistant Attorney General for Criminal were very much involved as lawyers in the Institute. They attended as before they took over their positions. They were attending as lawyers. So Merrick Garland, when he spoke in this past March, talked about how he used to come when he was a lawyer at Arnold and Porter. So, and he did. And it's interesting. Same with Lisa Monaco. But so we had Steve Trott. Steve Trott took a great interest in the Institute, and so he would come. Then Bill Weld did do that. Alice Fisher. And what was interesting is the Justice Department was willing to give us people to be on the planning committee, which is something initially they didn't want to because they thought that it maybe interfered be too much beyond their role. But that's really important because they're telling us what are the issues of importance to them. And I think Lisa Monaco spoke 2 years ago about some of the new things she was instituting at Justice. It's coming back to tell us in March how it has worked. The fact that we have a panel of enforcement and regulators so that we always get the director of enforcement of the SEC, the director of enforcement of CFTC, the head of export control, the assistant attorney general for antitrust, or people like that who are willing to come and tell us what are their priorities, what is it they're looking for, is really very, very important.
And may I just ask one question, Nina? I think probably on everybody's mind. Every day we suit up to go practice law or prosecute cases, defend cases, but the challenges are immeasurable in terms of professionalism and ethical issues as we think about it. And I know, Ray, there has been a judicial panel at the conference that I can't miss that panel because it's really good to be there. And I think Nina and I both, although we do different practices in some respects, different coast, East Coast, West Coast, maybe politically different in some ways. You know, we all have one core belief, which is we love the practice of law. We want to see it continue and be respected. But hearing from those judges is really useful. I thought maybe hearing from you today and Maggie about that would be helpful to the audience.
Yeah, pretty much the judges panel has become a staple, and so has the general counsel panel. And it's interesting because judges, we've never had a problem having them come because they've been willing to be on breakout panels. They've been on this main panel of judges and so on. But general counsel was difficult to get them involved because they have their own programs and their own group that they participate in. But it's very interesting that we have more and more GCs who are actually offering to come and speak. And this coming year, actually, we're adding one new thing that we've not done before. We're going to have a former CEO of a major multinational company, who was chairman and CEO, come and speak. He also is a director in about a dozen publicly traded companies. And he's going to talk about the involvement. What is the role of the board of directors and of individual directors when there is an investigation, when there's an internal investigation, when there's an announced government investigation? When do they set up special committees? How do they oversee it? Do they do it independent of management? How do they handle that? And that's something which we have not done before. So we're always trying to come up with ideas. And actually, that's where the planning committee comes. I mean, they have fantastic ideas, and they come up with those ideas.
Well, it sounds like March is going to be a hit in Miami. And to all of you out there in the audience, I couldn't recommend more strongly that you come attend the National Institute on White Collar Crime in March in Miami.
And the agenda, actually, this year we're really ahead of schedule. So the agenda will be on the website within the next week.
And that's the ABA Criminal Justice Section website.
The ABA Continuing Legal Education Section. And it may also be on the Criminal Justice Section. And the dates are March 1 to 3.
So what do you think, Joe? Yeah. I think our initial podcast, I hope, was informative for our audience. I think it was.
Yeah. We really had to start at this spot, Nina. I think both of us agreed it would be impossible for us to launch anything without getting Ray and Maggie on board talking about this premiere, this jewel in the crown of the Criminal Justice Section program that really, as Ray says, it's a price point that's incredible. You can't get a program at this price for this quality anyplace else. And it hopefully will continue, Ray and Maggie. Nina, we both have been there so many times, but every time I go, I always find, well, I get the chance to see you occasionally, which is wonderful, but I also get a chance to see all my friends, West Coast friends around the country. And it's just the camaraderie, Nina, that, you know, you and I have. Ray even likes me, and Maggie, I hope, or does too. But anyway, it's important to say we really, on the criminal side of the aisle, criminal practice is more civil than civil practice, I sometimes say, right? And so that's how we came together, Nina, to put this together for the ABA criminal justice section. So any final words, Nina?
Thank you, Ray and Maggie. Thanks for being with us. And I'm Nina Marino.
And I'm Joe Whitley. And we will be back in another 30 or so days with another podcast. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for listening to White Collar Crime Talks with Nina and Joe, an ABA Criminal Justice Section Just Pod series. Please join us for future episodes.